For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. So we're in the middle, some of us, of a two-month practice commitment period, or past the middle, I guess. And Nyozan Erik Shutt is our shuso, or head monk, head priest, head student for that, and he's going to be giving the talk this morning. So thank you very much, Nyozan.
Good morning, everybody. Having done this practice period so far, we've been studying a text called Mountains and Rivers Sutra. Those of you who know it know it. Those of you who don't, you don't need to. One of the things that surprised me in spending time with this text is that what has sort of opened up to me has been this new way for me of thinking about this aspect of the teaching that we receive that has to do with the harmony of difference and sameness. And so this has been coming up in my previous talks, and it will come up again. This has been a big surprise to me. And I'll explain that a little bit later for those of you who might be unfamiliar with the idea. But the real theme of this talk, I think it went on the website as Zen Wheels and Circles, and as I think about it, it is wheels and circles, but it's actually more kind of, not so much of it is specific to Zen, it's more the Dharma, you know, the wider family of Dharma, I think. And also I've had to, I spent about 10 minutes like thinking of the ways that circles and wheels appear in Buddhist thinking, particularly Zen thinking, and very quickly had myself completely tangled up, because there are a lot of them. It'd be a real rich theme for somebody to explore sometime. But I had to cut things back. So, just to mention a few things that I'm not going to talk about. I was thinking about this Enso. People know this circle. There, for those of you who've been in the Dokusan room, there's one, kind of an untraditional one by Kaz Tanahashi. Very beautiful, but it's just a very simple circle, symbol of either emptiness or universality. So I'll note that it appears in our wheel chant. We talk about the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. These themes of the circle and of wheels come up again and again. Today I'm going to talk just about three, and for those of you who are new here, I'll try to talk about it in a way that, I mean, some of it will be unfamiliar, I'm afraid, but some of it may sort of serve as a bit of review for some of the things you will have heard, and I take it you're taking a survey class of some kind, a survey of Buddhism, so it won't be totally foreign. So these three ideas are the idea of Dharma Chakra, or Dharma Wheel, and as part of that, maybe most of my talk, turning of the Dharma Wheel. I'm going to talk about Kechi Myaku, which is the... That's okay, right?
Sure.
Okay. Last time I showed the picture of it, you said, you shouldn't do that. So Kechi Myaku, it represents lineage. It's the... it literally means bloodline, something like that. I'll talk about those terms in a minute. But it has kind of a mandalic representation on our papers where, you know, essentially it's... It's the line from a student, starts with Shakyamuni, to his students' succession. And it goes around to whoever's receiving the papers as somebody who's done precepts or, possibly people when they receive transmission, they receive it again. But, one of the really interesting things about it is it forms a circle. So it's in its own right, it's this very beautiful mandala with all these beautiful names on it. you know, sort of going in and out because they have to make room for him. It goes around in a circle, and then it comes to the person who's received the precepts or whatever, and then goes back to Buddha. It's a circulation system. Very interesting. So I'm going to talk about that, and I am going to talk about Sangha. We don't usually talk about Sangha as a circle, but look around. It is kind of a circle. Sangha means community, broadly speaking. Okay, so as usual, my notes are not sequential. Oh, another wheel that we will not talk about much is the wheel of samsara, hugely important one. It's come up. It comes up here often, of course. But that's just another example of this hugely important idea of a circle and what all it means. Ultimately, why this recurring motif, I don't know. So the first thing I want to talk about is the Dharma Chakra. The Dharma Chakra literally means the Dharma wheel. Many of you who will have seen it, I don't know why it didn't occur to me to bring a representation of it. It's just a circle, it's got eight spokes, and those eight spokes represent the different parts of the Eightfold Path. The way the Dharma Chakra seems to have arisen historically is initially it was quite some time after Shakyamuni's time that there would actually be representations of Shakyamuni as a human being. So this became one of the symbols, that, sort of like the fish in early Christianity as a representation of something that otherwise wasn't represented. So where did this idea of the Dharma Chakra come from? Well, it goes back into the, most of you will be familiar with this, or many of you will be, in the early days of, before Shakyamuni was born, there were these prophecies, very important for the course of his life. One, you know, the prophecy basically was that either he would be a great ruler or he would be a great sage, Shakyamuni, sage of the Buddhas, sage of the Shakyas. The great king, the universal king, universal monarch in Indian mythology was called a Chakravartin. And that means a wheel-turning king. And what this wheel was in the mythology, those kings, or such a king, were he to appear, would have a magic wheel. And this wheel would turn around, roll around by itself, you know, taking in ever greater domains, greater territories that would then come under the beneficent rule of this monarch. So that's sort of where this idea of the wheel seems to have originated. But Shakyamuni instead became a great sage, did not become a great monarch. But, you know, as a matter of this sort of parallelism or whatever, this idea of the wheel became important. So just a couple of features of this wheel, of the eightfold wheel, or the eight-spoked wheel, that are seem fairly clear is that, talking about the Dharma Chakra, the Dharma wheel, then we start talking about the turning of the Dharma wheel. The first turning, what is called the first turning, and it has to do with what appears to have been the earliest strata of teaching that Shakyamuni presented. So without a lot of explanation, I don't think it's needed. Basically, these are the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and then this idea of dependent origination, which we've talked about here a lot. So these are the ideas that are represented in the first turning. wheel itself, the representation itself, I think, being put this way with the eight spokes, if anybody's ever ridden a bicycle and had a couple of spokes broken, you know how quickly the entire thing goes out of whack, that the wheel itself depends on all the spokes and the tension between the spokes, and then a relationship to maintain what we call balance, and also true, which has to do with, I won't get into that, but I think the wheel itself, the Dharma chakra, in itself is kind of an embodiment, a deep representation of this very important idea of dependent co-origination. So, one way to think about the turnings of the Dharma wheels we can sort of think about them in a historical sense, the sort of unfolding of Dharma, development of thinking of the Dharma over time. The way it's represented sort of poetically and in the tradition is that as Dharma develop and spread, as the wheel of Dharma rolls around the world and takes in greater territory, both in terms of physical territory, but also the development of the unfolding of the thinking that's inherent in the earliest Dharma that Shakyamuni presented. It's represented in the tradition as, well, you know, these things are not exactly the same, they're not exactly different, they're not exactly the same, so how do we account for them? It's because, you know, people were not fully ready to hear the full truth of what the Buddha was presenting. Therefore, to some groups of students, he would present the first turning and then the subsequent turnings. So that's one way of thinking about it. So we have this earliest turning of the wheel. There's a second turning of the wheel, and this is strongly associated with historically, with the rise of the Mahayana traditions. And the Mahayana tradition, of course, is kind of characterized by the emphasis on these two features of emptiness and compassion, and consequently the development of and the sort of valorization of the figure of the Bodhisattva over the more sort of renunciant kind of saints that came before. We could say that this emphasis on emptiness and compassion can be it's very deeply expressed in what we call the Paramita literature, Paramita Sutras, and then it's developed intellectually or at the level of discourse, particularly by this very important school of the Mahayana called the Madhyamakas, sometimes it's called the emptiness school. The Yogacara tradition, which I'll speak about in a minute, some of their texts sometimes characterize this as the Dharma wheel of signlessness, which is interesting given those of you who are familiar with the opening of the Mount Sriva Sutra. So what is this idea of emptiness that gets developed? Well, it's an unfolding. It's not exactly the same as this earlier notion of dependent co-arising. I mean, we can distinguish them, but it's obviously a development of it. It's not the same, but it's not different either. It's just an unfolding. It's an enrichment. It's making explicit what's there. And this idea of not one, not two, not the same, not different is very much a part of this turning of the wheel. So you know, whereas before, in the first training, we had ideas like anatman, the fact that people do not, you know, the not people, things, all things have no, what we call, own being. Here, it's this idea that, as I say, not one, not two. So when we think about, you know, we can think about selves, people, Dharma positions come up, but there's no way to think intelligibly about that, coherently about that, except as completely to see that as an expression, as an reflection, as a reflection of all other beings. So you know, in this turning of the wheel, we start to get this you know, lots of expressions. For example, it comes up in the Mountains and Rivers Sutra about the you know, the fact that sentient beings and Buddhas always arise together. And so in some sense, even Buddhas and sentient beings, you know, or Nirvana and Samsara, we can talk, they're distinguished, but at another level, at the sort of more refined levels of Mahayana thinking, you can't say that they're completely different. Self and other, Nirvana and Samsara, Buddhas and sentient beings, all of these things are characterized by this quality of not one, not two. I think, I won't go down this line now, but I think that the Zazen and precepts are also like this, personally. Part of what this means is, you know, and I won't develop this a great deal right here, but, you know, it's important to keep track of the fact that all of this means that emptiness itself is not a thing. It has no own being. It's a useful way of understanding relationships of all kinds. I mean, I don't know if that's an adequate way of putting it. But, okay, so that's the second turning of the wheel, the rise of the Mahayana, and particularly the Prajnaparamita literature and the Madhyamaka thinking of Nagarjuna and others. So the third turning of the wheel is sort of this, maybe we could talk about, there's this body of thinking called Yogacara. Sometimes it's called representation only or mind only. And I don't want to say a whole lot about that other than it's partly arises not as a contradiction of the Madhyamaka, this earlier emptiness thinking, but sort of developing this notion of the emptiness of emptiness, and consequently emphasizing actually, you know, it saw the earlier stuff as possibly being taken in a somewhat nihilistic way, and it shouldn't be, but it can be taken that way, and so it emphasizes the notion that when we talk about emptiness, it's actually something like fullness, that it doesn't mean, emptiness does not mean that Jeremy doesn't exist in a sense, or anybody else, my watch. It means that they dependently co-arise. And then when the conjunction of things that make them dependently co-arise disassociate, they subside. But the Yogacara emphasizes that side of things. So it's a side of particularity. It's a side of what we have called Dharma position. You know, the sort of provisional reality of particulars, it emphasizes this, what we call Buddha nature, and the full potential of everyone to wake up. There's this notion that Taigen talked about, I believe, last Monday, Tathagata Garbha, which has to do with either we can think of it as the embryo of of Buddhas or enlightenment or the womb, the matrix that in which that can arise. So this Dharma wheel in their own literature is sometimes called, as opposed to the Dharma wheel of signlessness, the Dharma wheel possessed of good differentiation, identifying these different things. So we see, what the point I want to make here is that, you know, this unfolds historically, and, you know, all of these things are quite different, but they are developments at each stage. None of this stuff sort of negates or overrides what happens before. It sort of opens up as the Dharma wheel sort of rolls over new dimensions and spins. It brings to light the features that were less explicit, but nonetheless inherent in what came before. So it's this great enriching. I'm going to talk a little bit about Kechimyaku, this idea of the circulation, or the way that lineage, the way the tradition itself is represented as a kind of circulation. And I'm going to use that to go back to this idea of development and say that, you know, actually we should think about the Dharma wheels as still rolling. It's not in place. I can tell I'm going to run out of time. So very, very quickly, when do we need to be done?
Oh, I don't know. Five after.
I'm okay. So I told you a little bit about this Kechimyaku. And, you know, I won't go say a lot more about that. But, you know, and I'm sure that there is some great secret lore about Kechimyaku and how it's represented, how this lineage is represented as a not only a circle, but as actually a circulatory system, a bloodline. But what seems obvious from this representation of, you know, coming around again and then the bloodline going back to Buddha is, it seems to be that, you know, again, there's this idea of part to whole, of you know, sameness and differentiation. But part of what seems to imply to me that because what runs through me and you is represented as nourishing the Buddha, you know, that blood goes back to Buddha in the same way that one runs through him is shown as sort of nourishing us, oxygenating us, all that stuff. That would seem to imply, and people can challenge me on this, but I think part of what's being expressed there is that to the extent the Buddha is alive, if we want to use that way of thinking about it, to the extent that the Dharma is a living thing, where can that be? Well, it can only be here, right? In us, in other practitioners, in people who continue to express the Buddha way, challenge themselves to find ways to express the Buddha way. Do we express the Buddha way in the same way the founders of our tradition did? Well, you know, I don't happen to be a 13th century monk. I don't speak Japanese, maybe just a little, but basically, you know, I'm not living on a mountain in China. I've never been to India. You know, I live a very, very different life than any of those people as I trace back along that bloodline. It's different. Nonetheless, you know, I guess we never can be entirely certain. But the aspiration has to be always that we, although we're in different times, different lives, different people, you know, that somehow we're connecting through our zazen, through our practice, you know, we are engaging in some essential sameness with what has come before, even though, you know, this temple doesn't look like any other temple. And that's just the way things are. But I think that's partly what's expressed by Techimyaku. So again, this idea of difference and sameness. This term, Kechimyaku, Kechi just means blood. You know, I think in our official stuff for our lineage, as it's translated in English, we say the blood vein sutra, but, you know, the idea is really more of, you know, vessel, especially when we consider this idea of circulation. But the second term, this myaku, should translate as blood or vessel. It can also mean pulse. You know, it's that liveliness. It's the, you know, it's not only is there is a circle, but there is something beating in there. And you know, and I guess that's what I mean by sameness. You know, we at least hope, we aspire that the heart that sort of beats in our practice will be the same as what has been beating all along, and that we can find a way to continue that. So the third circle I want to talk about is Sangha. We don't usually, I don't think, talk about it as a circle, but community. Part of what I'd like to say about that particular circle is that as we've seen, you know, as was part of the third turning, this Tathagarbha or this Yogacara kind of thinking, produces this, you know, it makes explicit this notion of Buddha nature, which is in no way exclusive. It all, very often it says that all beings, all human beings have this. All things have it, the potential for awakening. Our founder Dogen says, you know, it's more than that, it's all beings in some sense are it. But what that means is that, you know, we have this circle of Sangha that provides this kind of container in which we practice and in, you know, which we carry out our practice lives. But as is expressed, you know, in something like Mountains and Rivers and many, many other places, we can think about it as this sort of various degrees of concentric circles, but at the fundamental level, the very deepest level, there's nothing outside the circle. And so part of our task, part of the way we can unroll, you know, roll the wheel of Dharma in the current time, is to continue to sort of make explicit that nothing should be outside of that circle. Nothing should be outside the range of our bodhisattvic concern. And so, I mean, this is partly why something like Mountains and Rivers is such a useful, beautiful text, is that one of the particular ways in which I think many folks think we should be thinking about this now is sort of explicitly, very diligently, find ways to bring our suffering ecological realm into the realm of, into our circle of concern and protection and bodhisattvic activity, that kind of thing. And this may be particular. I mean, I talked a few weeks ago about, you know, there's this particularity of Dharma positions. I think Sanghas kind of have a kind of collective Dharma position in the same way we can talk about collective karma. And it may be, you know, different Dharma positions have different sort of obligations and responsibilities, things they need to take care of. And I would at least raise the possibility that this is one that we should be concerned about. So in thinking about the circle of Sangha and how you talk about this sameness and difference with Sangha, I came up with this, which people will recognize as a Mobius strip. They've got all kinds of really interesting properties. I was trying to bone up on the mathematics of Mobius strips last night. It's hopeless for me, not for you maybe. But one of the things about this is that we see a kind of boundedness, right? A kind of particularity. So we could think of this strip as us, and the, you know, our little circle of practice and energy most immediately. But the odd feature of a Mobius strip is that even though there's this sort of provisionally bounded space, there's nothing outside this circle, nothing inside the circle, or you can't talk in terms of inside and outside, because you know there's actually, as you know, as you go around, there's only one surface. So in a sense, everything on either side occupies the same space. So what I'm trying to convey here is that we can think of Sangha as like this. You know, we can operate, you know, within our most immediate range of operation, but should always be thinking that there's nobody ultimately and no thing against which we can sort of posit ourselves as separate or different, except in the most provisional, temporary kind of way, right? And I would think, maybe I tore that thing too soon. You know, this is a sort of a coda, you know, this idea of difference and sameness in circles. You know, maybe this is a good image to think about the relationship of our practice to the rest of our lives, right? Because obviously, here we are this morning, we're doing this thing together. It makes sense to think of our practice lives as this kind of independent thing, right? It's not exactly the same as what I'm doing, you know, what I'll be doing on Tuesday afternoon, wherever I am, it won't be here. On the other hand, if we're thinking about it as being too different from that, or too separate from that, or somehow like this, rather than like this, you know, then we may be having, you know, maybe a good time to sort of reconsider the nature of our practice and how we're integrating things. So that's basically, you know, what I came up with. And, you know, there is this really, you know, rich, there are all kinds of circles. And I would encourage anybody, you know, who gets a Dharma talk here in the future, you know, Taigen or somebody else, to maybe explore some of the other kind of circles, because it turns out to be kind of pervasive. But anyway, thank you for listening. And if anybody has any remarks, please. Yes.
Oh, it's torn. Yeah. It's torn now, but it's never torn.
There you go.
Yeah. So you have to hold it in place, but it's amazing because you end up on the other side of where you were. If you hold on to it, you can pass it around. Questions, comments, responses for Nyozon, please?
David. Just when I was struck at the very beginning of being a cyclist, how we always talk about truing our spokes.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, oh, I get it. Like that's they actually took the term from maybe, I don't know.
I don't know.
But we talk about truing your spokes.
Riding the wheel and truing the spokes. I mean, maybe we should talk it. I think bicycles would make an excellent. Well, we've got Tricycle Magazine, right? But even bicycles would be a good theme for a Dharma talk.
I guess who's done that already.
That's right.
Can be done again.
Could be done again.
So this is related to dukkha, right?
It is related to dukkha. I mean, please elucidate.
I don't know, Sanskrit? But I've heard that dukkha, which is the term for the discomfort that we experience in our lives, that brings us to practice, is a wheel that's out of truth. And that happiness is a wheel that's in balance.
So that wheel that's out of true, as it spins, you know, it wobbles, there's friction.
But the Eightfold Path is this wheel that keeps on rolling very comfortably, right? So
yeah.
Peace from suffering, something like that.
Thank you.
Also, don't like Buddhists sit in like the midst of fire, the ring of fire, something like that too?
What's that?
Buddhists sit in the midst of a ring of fire.
Yes, I do. I was immediately going to Johnny Cash. Yeah.
He's a good Buddhist, yeah.
Yeah. Dharma, 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 keep the Dharma rolling.
Other questions or comments, anyone?
Is there anything that people, I mean, your questions, if anything I said was sort of unclear or whatever you want to ask about that, that's fine too. You know, or I'm happy to entertain anything that people thinks it may be wrong or inappropriate about the way I put things.
I can add a little bit about the Kechimyaku, the blood
Please.
Pulse, and I like that you talked about it as pulse as well as vein, but that's the lineage papers that we give when people formally take the precepts, lay ordination or priest ordination, but that, as Nyozan described, it's this circle that goes from Buddha through all these, you know, pseudo-historically at least, we don't know all the names, but through India, through China, through Japan, out of America. But the point of the document is that through all these names at the bottom is your name and receiving the precepts, and then that feeds back to Buddha. So part of the point of that circle is just that we are here doing the Buddha work. We're, you know, in Chicago in May 2014, this is it. This is Buddha's work. This is Buddha's life. So, and renewing that. So part of a circle is also renewal and continuing that and keeping it rolling. So that's what we're doing. Finding a way to do the Buddha work in all the different aspects and all of the different teachings that Nyozen referred to in this life, in this place, in Chicago, here. So how we take on, you know, for all of us, whether we formally receive the precepts or not, that we are receiving this tradition of wheels, which is one way to put it, this circle of Buddhas, and we're sharing that together in this circle of Sangha, and so that's our practice.
And, you know, just thinking about this, the kind of inherent metaphor of a bloodline, well, part of the way a bloodline works is by, what it's moving around is this kind of oxygen that it brings in from the outside. And, you know, of course we can, you know, think about some of the things that are happening throughout the world, and certainly in the emergence of Western Buddhism as sort of bringing in a new kind of oxygen that keeps things fresh, so we can think about things such as more democratic decision making. We can think about the way that women are being brought strongly into the tradition in a way they had to some. I mean, we've got this wonderful book that shows that there's this buried history, but at least at the level of explicit history, women have been excluded for a long time. All kinds of things like that, and we see, you know, the development of this sort of ecological thinking, you know, on sort of Buddhist principles, you know, and such things as the ordination of trees in Southeast Asia as a means to protect forests because the loggers are reluctant to offend a Buddhist monk. So if you ordain a tree, you protect the forest. Anyway, just riffing off of that.
Good. Well, thank you very much. Any last questions or comments or responses, anyone?
I was just, you know, it was fascinating about, you know, your teachings, you know, and the representation of the circle. And I was just thinking about the compass, you know, and the directions mm-hmm. that we go, and it could be represented, you know, in a circle, and there's many different directions, but it's all connected. And
yeah. Yeah.
Good.
But, I mean, this thinking again, I mean, this, you know, another of these sort of circles and wheels, just think about the entire, you know, there's this whole business in Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, it's just everywhere, so.
Did someone else have a comment or question?
I just had a comment that it's interesting to me when you think of the bloodline, like having heard so many times about the story of Suzuki Roshi coming to the San Francisco and then knowing some people that, or having met some people that he has trained, and then knowing that feels very real to me. That feels very alive. I can see that circle. Going beyond that, it's very nebulous. You know, it's like it's hard to relate to the people, you know, that Suzuki Roshi was influenced by, or the generations before him. You know, that becomes more, you have to move into your imagination. But I just thought it was interesting how you can see the bloodline when it's closer to, you know, the generations mm-hmm. that you've witnessed, or more, you know, more closely. It's harder to connect with the ones that are more removed, you know, back 4 or 5 generations.
It's the same as our, you know, our more literal ancestors, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we can have every confidence that they're back there, even though we don't know them as well.
Well, thank you very much, Nirzan.
Thank you.